All right, so this is Bio160, and it's Tuesday, September 16th. And I want to remind you that you do have a quiz on Thursday over this chapter and the next one. So hopefully we'll get into the next chapter today. But those questions come right from the student study guide, so you can start reviewing for the quiz immediately and start getting ready for those questions. Right, so what is that? That's chapters 4 and 5, I believe. So that's going to be metabolism and then tissues. So a couple questions on tissues. All right, so let's start up with metabolism, and in particular respiration, cellular respiration. And what the heck is the purpose of cellular respiration? It's good if you can remember what the, if we're going to look at all of these different things happening inside the cell, but it's really good to maintain some perspective as to why all this stuff is going on and just look at a nice, real simple answer so that you can understand, appreciate why we have some complexity that we have to deal with and learn about. So what's the purpose of cellular respiration? To make energy, this is true. And in particular, what form is that energy in? ATP. So the whole point of cellular respiration is to make ATP. That's really why it goes on inside of our cells. And there are two main ways to make ATP in our cells. There is anaerobic respiration and aerobic respiration. And so you need to be able to compare and contrast these two different ways in terms of what metabolites are necessary, where they take place in the cell, but also the amount of ATP that is produced by these different kinds of metabolisms. Is that focus? Yeah, that's focused pretty nice. All right. So anaerobic respiration, the nice thing about these two terms right here is it tells you a lot about the processes that are taking place and in terms of an important metabolite that's necessary or not necessary for this particular form of respiration. So anaerobic respiration means that it's respiration that can take place without a certain molecule. And what is that certain molecule?
Oxygen.
That's oxygen, right? So anaerobic respiration can make ATP even when there is no oxygen present, as contrasted to aerobic respiration, which is respiration that needs oxygen, right? So this needs an additional molecule, and you might say, well, that doesn't sound so good if we need something else to make ATP. So there must be an advantage of aerobic respiration over anaerobic respiration, and we'll see what that is. So anaerobic respiration starts with a glucose molecule, and glucose is just cut in half. It's snipped in half. And when you break something apart, we call that lysis. When we break a cell, that's the lysis of that cell. And you know an organelle inside the cell whose job it is to break things down, like the lysosome, right? So you're familiar with that term, lysis, already. So when we cut glucose in half to make two pyruvate molecules, we call this process glycolysis. Glycolysis. That just is what? The lysis of glucose, chopping it in half. And when you chop it in half through this metabolic pathway, and this pathway right here has about 8 or 9 different steps involved. We're not going to learn all the different steps. All right. It produces 2 ATP. And this can happen without oxygen. And now where does this take place? In the cytosol. So we don't need organelles. There are enzymes that are just dissolved in the cytosol that allow for this reaction to take place, including the production of this ATP. All right, so what pathway does it require? And as a matter of fact, I wrote it on the board right there, right? Glycolysis is the name of that pathway that can convert glucose into 2-pyruvate. As a matter of fact, I'll put little 2 right there because there are 6 carbons in glucose, and when you break it down right smack in the middle, you get actually 2 pyruvates, and there's 3 carbons in pyruvate, right? And that also produces these 2 ATPs. So the pathway that's required is glycolysis. And you have a pretty good picture. You have actually a couple pictures in your textbook that show this. Where are these at? And I showed one of the pictures to you before. And there, I put them in a really nice, neat order. Okay. Good. Here it is right here. So here we have a picture of a cell. Here is the cell membrane. What's another name for a cell membrane? That's a plasma membrane. So that's a plasma membrane that's separating the outside world with the inside world over here. So that's what that line represents. So all of this area in here is the cytosol. This is just the fluid part of inside the cell. But now here's another organelle, this inner line. Right here is another organelle. And that line represents the membrane of a mitochondria. Right? So when we look at this whole cell, including the mitochondria, we see that glycolysis, which means the conversion of glucose into 2-pyruvate, just chopping the glucose in half and producing 2-ATP, happens where? In the cytosol, not in the mitochondria. All right, and so we consider that anaerobic respiration because nowhere in here do we see that oxygen is necessary. That's anaerobic metabolism. And all cells can do that, even very, very primitive cells. But if it's a real primitive cell, it does not have a mitochondria. And for every glucose molecule, then, that very primitive cell can only make 2 ATPs from every glucose. But fortunately, we have very sophisticated cells making up our bodies, and they have mitochondria inside of them. They can extract even more energy from the leftover products of glycolysis to make, what, ATP. So this pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria. This represents mitochondria right here. And there are two chemical processes that take place. There is one that we call the citric acid cycle, and that chops every carbon off of the pyruvic acid and produces a CO2. And guess what we do with that CO2? We just breathe it out of our body, so mitochondria are producing CO2 that we actually excrete by exhaling out of our bodies. And in so doing, okay, then the citric acid cycle produces some high-energy electrons that are contained within the mitochondria right here, and these electrons run through a number of other components within the membrane that we call the electron transport chain. So these electrons hop from one molecule to another, and when they do that, right, the mitochondria can make an additional 34 ATPs for every glucose molecule that this pyruvate came from. All right, so this is where we left off last time. So what's more efficient in terms of making ATP? Is it the stuff that's happening inside the mitochondria or outside the mitochondria? Inside, right? But all of the stuff that's happening inside the mitochondria is dependent on one kind of molecule that these mitochondria need. Not only does it need pyruvic acid, which comes from glucose, but it also needs oxygen right here. And without oxygen, all of these processes stop, and when they stop, the mitochondria can't make this ATP, and highly metabolic tissues in your body, like your brain and your heart, will die in just a matter of minutes without the production of ATP from this mitochondria here. Okay, so don't forget, we're learning all these different pathways like glycolysis and the citric acid cycle, electron transport, where they take place in the cell. But the bottom line is, why is the cell undergoing respiration right here? What's the purpose? Is to make these ATP. That's right, it's to make ATP, the energy for the cell. So the purpose is not to consume glucose. The purpose is not to break down pyruvic acid. The purpose is not really to produce CO2. These things happen during respiration, but that's not the prime reason, right? And the purpose is not to use up oxygen in our body, although that happens. But the purpose is what? Specifically to make ATP. And the oxidative phosphorylation, which takes place in the mitochondria, is much more efficient. Right, so this is what aerobic respiration is, much more efficient than anaerobic respiration. All right, so when you look at this scheme right here, what's the last molecule that's formed with aerobic respiration, which is the most efficient kind of respiration? What's the last molecule that actually forms? It's one that you're familiar with years before you even took this class. And it's kind of amazing. It is? Yeah, that water molecule right there. Okay, so When we make ATP, your body is also making some water. That oxygen that we breathe in actually turn up in that water molecule right there. And so these electrons combine with oxygen to form that water molecule. Okay, so I think that's one of the study questions, if you're working on your study questions already. All right, so for anaerobic respiration, how many ATPs can be made for every glucose? A measly 2. All right, but if you have this glycolysis working with aerobic respiration, how many ATPs can be made? You got these two over here plus these 34, so about 36. Under different conditions, this number might change a little bit, so you see a little range of numbers right here. But always you want to say 30-something for aerobic respiration versus 2 for anaerobic respiration, right? And in this class, usually I don't like to test you on numbers very much, but I think these numbers are pretty important to know because they're actually pretty fascinating to see, right? 2 versus 30-something. And 30-something is a whole lot better than just a measly 2. Okay. All right, so the breakdown of ATP. How is that broken down? Generally speaking, that kind of reaction is what, anabolism or catabolism? Breaking down is catabolism. Building up is anabolism. And one of the features of catabolism, right, when you break something down, is energy consumed or released? It is released. So when ATP is hydrolyzed, that energy is released, and that energy can be used for cellular activity, like muscle contraction, or the beating of your heart, or thinking a thought, or controlling something in your body. All right, so you had a slide of ATP. All right, remember this slide? That's ATP right here with 3-phosphates. And then the catabolism of ATP, which releases energy, looks like this. So here is that ATP. I showed you this slide already with the 3-phosphates. This last phosphate gets hydrolyzed off. That means water molecule has to be split. And an OH goes over here, and an H goes over here. So an inorganic phosphate comes off, and you're left with an ADP. And this is DP because of the diphosphate, right? And then that releases energy for cellular reactions, metabolic reactions that require energy. But then how does your body make more ATP? You know two ways now. It needs ADP. And what are the two main ways that you can make ATP from ADP? Aerobic respiration, right? And with mitochondria requiring oxygen, that means you can convert 30-something ADPs back to ATP for every glucose, or if there is no oxygen in the tissues, then ADP can be converted back to ATP via glycolysis, but you can only make 2 ATP for every glucose as an energy molecule. Okay. All right, so let's change our attention now to look at nucleotides and the structure of nucleic acids. All right, so the basic building block of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide, right? And we have two different kinds of nucleic acids. There's something called DNA, and then there's something called RNA. And the building block of these two are what? They're the same. They're nucleotides, right? Okay. So, and a nucleotide has these basic features. There's a 5-carbon sugar, and that sugar could either be a deoxyribose or a ribose sugar, but in every case, it's just a 5-carbon sugar. There's a phosphate group, so that should kind of remind you of a molecule already. What is that? If I say phosphate group, what does it sort of remind you of? What is a molecule that has 3-phosphate groups on it? ATP, right? And ATP is actually a nucleotide that we're going to see. And a nucleotide will also have some kind of base associated with it. And we've got 5 different kinds of bases. There's either adenine or guanine. And then there's thymine, cytosine, and uracil. These are the possible bases. So what the heck is a nucleotide? Here is, all right, this is a nucleotide. But this is a triphosphate nucleotide. So here is the sugar, here is the base, and here is a phosphate group right here. So just try to remember the form of what ATP looks like. And we'll represent it like this. So here is an example of DNA, and we can see a phosphate group and a sugar, and a phosphate group and a sugar. This forms a nice chain. So DNA is a nice long linear molecule, and sticking off the side of the sugar right here is a base. So this would be adenine. The T, what does the T stand for? Thymine, and G stands for guanine, and C for cytosine. And so I'm never going to say those words again. I'll just say A, T, G, C, so you know what I'm talking about. And I can talk faster that way, too. So the bases are sticking out to the side. And so the chain is formed by alternating units of what? Phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, right? Just like that. And these are the bases that make up DNA, only these four. Only adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. Oh, I said I wasn't going to do that anymore. Oh, well, sorry. Okay. So ATGC are the bases. All right. So in DNA, there is always found as a double strand. So DNA is a double-stranded molecule, and it looks like this. So here is one strand. Here is the second strand. So these right here, this kind of, to me, looks like a spiral staircase a little bit. So the handrails, or the rails of the stairway, are made out of what parts of the nucleotides? Can you picture what's going on right here? You have alternating units of phosphate and sugar, phosphate and sugar, phosphate and sugar. And then poking into the center, making up the ladder, right, are the bases. And what are the bases that you have in DNA? G, C, or A and T? And DNA will form this nice double-stranded structure, which we call a double helix, because a G and a C will fit together very nicely on the inside of this molecule. G won't fit together properly with the T, and G won't fit properly with another G. All right? The only way for these strands to come together is if G base pairs with a C, and that's determined basically by the shape of these two bases. Right? Conversely, A will never bind or base pair with G or C. It will only base pair with T, which is thymine, just because of the shape. Right? So you can see that the A and G are relatively big molecules, the C and T are relatively small, and that just they just pair up that way because of their shape. Okay. So what's important for you to know about DNA is that these handrails are made out of the sugar and phosphate part of a nucleotide, and what's sticking out in the middle over here, sort of like making the steps of the alpha helix right here, those are the bases coming together, and the base pairing rules are GC and AT. So there are different ways that you can recognize that this is DNA besides that it tells you right here. Okay. You can tell because it is double-stranded and because there is thymine in it, or T. The other kind of nucleic acid, which is RNA, is single-stranded, and the thymine right here is never found. All right. Instead, you would have a uracil or a U in this particular location. So, we have types of nucleic acids. We've got deoxyribonucleic acid. The sugar is deoxyribose. That means, what the heck does that mean? Let me find that ATP molecule again. So, if this is a nucleotide, in this location right here, if this was DNA, we would just have a hydrogen atom in this location. But if it was an RNA molecule, we would have actually an OH in this location. So an OH or what? An H. And if there's only an H minus that oxygen, you call it deoxynucleotide because it's missing an oxygen. But if there is an oxygen right there, we just call it a ribonucleotide because that's what the ribose sugar looks like. It has an oxygen. So does it look like there's a big difference between a DNA nucleotide and an RNA nucleotide? Only that little oxygen right there. Okay, that's the biggest difference, which is really subtle. I think that's a kind of small difference. Okay. So for DNA, you've got the deoxyribose sugar. The four bases are A, which pairs with T, and then you got C, which pairs with G, G-C-A-T, and it's double-stranded, and the strands twist to form that double spiral ladder, which we call the double helix. So that's what you have to know about some of the things about DNA. All right, now what about RNA? RNA has that oxygen on that sugar, so it's not deoxyribose, it's the actual ribose sugar. And the bases are a little bit different. You still have cytosine and guanine, and they base pair together, which we call CG, base pairing. But instead of thymine, you have uracil. So now the base pairing rules change. You have AU instead of AT for RNA. So if somebody shows you a long string of nucleotides, which forms a nucleic acid, you can tell if it's DNA or RNA just by looking to see if there's thymine or uracil. And if there's thymine, you know it is DNA. And if it's uracil, you know it is RNA. Right. Okay. Another thing to remember is that RNA, also being different from DNA because it is single-stranded. It only has one strand. It never forms the double helix like DNA does. So that's another nice distinction. Okay. Well, let's talk about DNA replication. What the heck does DNA replication mean, even? So, can you remember what mitosis is all about? What's mitosis about? It's making, it's the replication of a cell, starting with one cell, and then it's going to replicate itself, making two cells. And those two cells we call daughter cells. And what's the difference between those two daughter cells? There should be nothing different about them. And what's the difference between the daughter cells and the parent cell, the one they came from? Again, there should be nothing different about them, right? So the genetic material in the daughter cell should be equal to the genetic material that was in the parent cell. So in order for mitosis to take place, the DNA has to be replicated before mitosis starts. You have to make an additional copy of the DNA so that both daughter cells have the exact same amount as the parent cell. All right, so let's take a look at this nucleic acid. And this nucleic acid right here, so I'm covering up some details. This nucleic acid right here, can you tell me if that is RNA or DNA? And why? It's DNA. How do you know that's DNA? Doesn't have a U. It has a T. And what's another way? It's double-stranded, right? You see two strands. So you see these two handrails right here alternating phosphate sugar. And then the steps are made out of the bases. And again, what kind of sugar is made, incorporated into this handrail right here? It's the deoxyribose. That's where the D in DNA comes from. Deoxyribose, it's the ribose missing that little oxygen. And you can see the base pairing rules. All right, well, let's make another copy of this DNA molecule. How do we do that? Well, first, we have to unzip the molecule. We're going to break the two strands apart. And I didn't tell you what kind of bonds are holding these bases together for base pairing rules, but they are hydrogen bonds. And what can you tell me about a hydrogen bond? Is it a strong bond or a weak bond? You know what? A covalent is strong, and an ionic bond is pretty weak, And a hydrogen bond is even weaker still. So you know what? It's really easy to unzip this molecule because the hydrogen bonds come apart very easily. Right? So let's unzip the molecule. So it's unzipped. And now, since it's unzipped, this strand of DNA, these bases that make up this strand of the original DNA, can act as a template to start making RNA. So here is a thymine in DNA, of course. What can base pair with this thymine? It's going to be A, and it's going to be for a ribonucleotide because we're making... Oh, no. This is DNA. So I'm sorry. We're just making more DNA right here. So A is going to base pair with T. And this G right here, C base pairs with it. And this A, T, the thymine base pairs with it. So these nucleotides come in, and they bind to the original DNA strand. And then they're joined together via a dehydration synthesis reaction, just like what we've seen before. And a new strand is formed. Right? So what's important right here to see is that both old strands of the DNA, this is what we started with, an old strand, are used as a template to make a new strand of DNA so that after this process is completed, you have two new chromosomes, and each chromosome has one strand of the old DNA and one strand of the new DNA. And the other chromosome has one strand of the old DNA and one strand of the new DNA. So we call that semi-conservative replication. The old DNA is conserved, right? But the new chromosome is half old and half new. All right, and then these double strands are zipped back together again to form a nice chromosome. All right, so what's real important for you to see is that this original DNA molecule is never broken in the middle anyplace. It just separated. The two strands are separated because if it was broken in the middle, right, then that information would be lost. You wouldn't know what the sequence of nucleotides was in that DNA molecule. Right, so it's really important to keep both strands of the old DNA and use them as a template to make a new DNA. And then you have two copies of that DNA, and it should be equal to what it was before it was replicated. So that's replication. We call that semi-conservative replication. Okay, protein synthesis. We actually looked at this already, but protein synthesis, right, is the conversion of information in RNA to, information in DNA into RNA, and then the information in RNA is used to make a polypeptide. So you see it's what, a two-step process? The first step is what we call transcription. That's actually like making a duplicate copy, because what's the building block of DNA? It is nucleotide. What's the building block of RNA? Nucleotide. So that's the same language. It's only different really by that one little oxygen atom and the substitution of uracil for thymine in RNA. All right, so where does that happen? Where does transcription take place? Transcription means the conversion of DNA into RNA. But where does that happen? Where inside the cell? Inside the nucleus. Because why? The DNA just never leaves the nucleus. Because if it does, it could get cut someplace. And then that whole chromosome is useless. And then the cell might die. Chances are it would die as a result of that. All right, so transcription happens in the nucleus. Then the RNA does what? Leaves the nucleus. Goes into the cytosol. And part of it is used to make a ribosome. And then that ribosome can get busy using a messenger RNA to make a polypeptide or a protein. So again, what's the building block of this messenger RNA? That's a nucleotide. What's the building block of a polypeptide or a protein? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. So we're going from one language, a nucleotide language, to an amino acid language. When you go from one language to another, what do you call that? That's translation, right? So that's the second step for protein synthesis. And where does translation take place? Does not happen in the nucleus, because that's where transcription takes place. The RNA leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytosol, and so translation happens in, you could say, cytosol or cytoplasm. Either one of those would be good for me. Okay, probably maybe cytoplasm would be a little bit better. All right, this next section I'm going to cut out. We're not so interested in that. All right, what else do I say about transcription right here? Let's see if I have anything important to say about this. That's not just a review. All right, yeah, transcription is just a process of copying DNA instructions. Okay, that's what forms a gene into RNA. And don't forget the base pairing rules for transcription are AU, all right, and GC. RNA is single-stranded. And I'm not sure we covered this before, but there are three kinds of RNA that are made. The first kind, which is kind of easy to see, which is B right over here, is rRNA. That's what makes up a ribosome. Can you picture what a ribosome looks like? And that's the diagram of a cell. It was what? It was a little tiny, tiny dot. Really, really small. Doesn't have a membrane around it. It's just a clump of two different pieces of RNA that have come together. And that's where translation actually takes place. So we say rRNA or ribosomal RNA, that's the carpenter's workbench. That's where a protein is actually made. That's the physical structure. All right, the next one is messenger RNA. That's the instruction for how to spell out a protein. So what do I mean by spelling out a protein? How would you spell out a protein? How would you spell a word? By taking a letter and placing it, what, next to another letter, next to another letter? Like, spell your name. Yeah, so that's how you would spell somebody's name, right, in English. But how would we spell out a protein? We would take, an amino acid in the first position, and then the name of another amino acid in the second, and then the name of another amino acid in the third, and so a protein is just a linear sequence of amino acids, and it's the messenger RNA that tells the ribosome what the sequence of amino acids is in a protein, how to put them together. So we say then that the messenger RNA carries the codes, right, or the codons for synthesizing a polypeptide. And then the last one is the transfer RNA. Where's that? The transfer RNA. So far we've talked about ribosomal RNA and messenger RNA. So the ribosome is where a protein is being made, and the messenger RNA is telling the ribosome how to make it. But what else does the ribosome need in order to make a protein besides the messenger RNA? It needs the building blocks, the actual building blocks of the protein. What are the building blocks of the protein? Amino acids. So there's got to be something that brings amino acids to the ribosome so they can be put together to make a protein. And that's the function of the transfer RNA. It carries amino acids to the ribosome so that they can be used to make a protein. So a lot of times, I don't call it a transfer RNA. I kind of use a little slang term. I call it a taxi RNA. Because what are these amino acids doing? They're just hopping a ride on the tRNA to get to a ribosome so it can be incorporated into a protein. Okay. And probably this section right here, I'm not going to go over either. But if you're really interested in translation, that's a nice little synopsis of it. So I'll show you, I think this is a pretty good example. Some nice figures right here. So let's look at this. So here we have a cell. Here's cytoplasm. Here's the nuclear envelope. So what do we got in here? This is the nucleus. right? And here's a chromosome. And what kind of nucleic acid is this chromosome made out of? What kind of nucleic acid is this right here? It looks what? Double-stranded to me. So that's got to be DNA or deoxyribonucleic acid. All right, so transcription, what has to happen? First, we unzip the molecule. Is that easy to do? Yeah, because it's only hydrogen bonds holding these two strands together. And there's an enzyme that comes along and starts to base pair ribonucleotides to this DNA strand. So let's zoom into this region right over here. Here is the DNA strand, and we got what? TACCCGAG. That's just a sequence of nucleotides on the DNA molecule. Now, how is RNA going to base pair? This T right here is going to base pair with an A. And this A on the DNA is going to base pair with, not a T because we're making RNA, it's going to base pair with a U, right, all the way down the line, right? And then after the RNA is made, it unzips from the DNA molecule. Is that hard to do or easy to do? That's easy to do because of those hydrogen bonds. The RNA molecule does what? Leaves the nucleus, so the DNA stays inside the nucleus. It's protected. The RNA goes out, and it can be used, right, to make a ribosome, or it can be used as a messenger or a message to make a polypeptide, and also for these things right here. These are the little transfer RNAs that are bringing in these ovals, and these ovals represent different amino acids that are going to be put into this protein right here. Okay. Now, how many nucleotides do we have in this RNA molecule? Not in total, but how many different kinds of nucleotides do we have in this messenger RNA? You know the base pairing rules for... Yeah, you only have four. You have what? Adenine and uracil, cytosine and guanine. So you only have four nucleotides. But how many different amino acids are there in your body that can be used? There are actually... Oh, I have it in your notes. I didn't go over it at the time. Okay, there are 20 different kinds of amino acids. Where do I have it in your notes? Yeah, it's in there. It's in this chapter someplace. Maybe I'll find it before I stop. It's not on the last slide. Four, five. What about page three? Is it on page three? I'm going to have to just tell you. There's two. There are 20 different kinds of amino acids that can be used to make a protein. So you have many more different kinds of amino acids than you have nucleotides. So that just means that one nucleotide cannot code or call for the insertion of one amino acid in a protein. Because if that were true, you could only have four different amino acids. If you only had four different nucleotides. So you need a combination of nucleotides to cover all of the possible kinds of amino acids that you can put into a protein. And as it turns out, there's a sequence of three nucleotides in the messenger RNA that will determine what amino acid is placed in the protein. And so that sequence of three nucleotides is what we call a codon. That's the codon, and the codon is always found in the messenger RNA. mRNA, right? If one nucleotide could code for one amino acid, then you could only code for four amino acids. But you have many more than that in your body. You have 20. Here are some examples of amino acids. There's methionine, glycine, serine, alanine, threonine, right? So we need what we call a triplet code to determine what amino acid is used to spell out the sequence of amino acids in a protein. All right, well, let's look at some of these questions right here. Let's see if I got the same questions you do for this chapter. What's the purpose of cellular respiration? Make ATP. Really nice and simple, right? And do you need ATP? Yeah. Yes, because without blood going to your brain, bringing in oxygen for mitochondria to make ATP, how long do you have consciousness for? 3 seconds. That's right. And then you run out of ATP and you lose consciousness. All right. What's the difference between anabolism and catabolism? Let's say anabolism first. Building up. Making big molecules out of little ones. What else can you tell me about it? Requires energy. And a good place where you could get energy from is ATP as well. All right. And catabolism is what? It releases energy. And it's the breaking down of big molecules into small ones. That's catabolism. All right. All right. So question number 3. What are two kinds of respiration? Anaerobic and aerobic respiration. Where does anaerobic respiration take place? Cytoplasm or cytosol? Either one of those I like. Where does aerobic respiration take place? In mitochondria. Right. What are the products of aerobic respiration and anaerobic? All right, what are the products of aerobic respiration? Aerobic. That's the hard one. Maybe we'll start with the easy one first. What are the products of anaerobic respiration? It is 2 ATP and 2 pyruvic acids. And what does anaerobic respiration need in order to make 2 pyruvic acids and those 2 ATP? Anaerobic, no oxygen. It needs the energy molecule glucose. It needs glucose. And remember, glycolysis is just the splitting of glucose into 2 3-carbon molecules that we call pyruvate. So that's anaerobic respiration, 2 ATP. 2 pyruvic acids. Now what about aerobic respiration? What are the products of aerobic respiration? A little bit more complicated. Good place to start. ATP, because that's really the whole purpose of respiration. And instead of 2, it is 34. 32 to 34, 30 to 34, 30 something, which is a lot compared to 2. What else is produced?
Water.
And is that like the first thing that's produced or the last thing? That's the last thing that's produced. And water. What else is produced? Oxygen. That's pretty good. Pretty good. Pretty good. Oxygen's involved. But you know what? We don't produce oxygen. Plants do. Okay. So that's not us. We produce CO2. That's right. The glucose that we consume ends up completely turned into carbon dioxide. And we breathe that out of our bodies. And what do plants do? They gobble up that CO2, put it back together again to make glucose just by sitting in the sun. Would that be great if you could just go to the beach and like make a milkshake all day long just by sitting in the sun? That's what plants do. They make glucose. Okay. So that's the big difference. Let me just say it again real quick. The products of aerobic respiration, 30-something ATP, carbon dioxide, and water. That's a product of aerobic respiration. Where do the carbon atoms in CO2 come from when we exhale it in breathing? Where is it? What molecule do these carbon dioxides come from? What molecule? Yeah, somebody said. I heard way back there. It is glucose. Yeah, the carbon atoms in glucose are converted into CO2. Number 6, what's the last molecule produced by anaerobic? By anaerobic respiration, yeah, I would say pyruvic acid. Pyruvic acid, pyruvate. ATP is made along the way, but you didn't see that in this book, but that's true. So the last molecule is pyruvic acid. What about aerobic respiration? What's the last molecule produced by aerobic respiration? H2O. Right, when those oxygens that we breathe in accept those electrons, that produces water. And when all those pathways are operating, they just make a ton of ATP for us. What's the structure of DNA? It's double-stranded. And the building block is a nucleotide. And we put nucleotides together to make DNA. What makes the handrails? The phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. What makes the stairs in the double helix? The base is sticking out into the middle, or sticking into the middle of the molecule. All right, what sugar is found in DNA? Deoxyribose. Deoxyribose. What bases are found in DNA? And as a matter of fact, while we're at it, what are the base pairing rules for DNA? ATGC. So those are the four nucleotides and the base pairing rules as well. And they base pair by the shape, and the shape allows hydrogen bonds to form between the bases. All right, what are the three kinds of RNA? T, M, and R. Right? All right, and what do they do? Where should we start? How about the rRNA? That's an easy place. What does the rRNA do? It makes something. It makes a ribosome. The rRNA makes a ribosome. And the tRNA, it acts like acts as a taxi or a transfer molecule. It brings amino acids to the ribosome, so a ribosome can make a protein. And the messenger RNA determines what? Yeah, it determines the sequence of amino acids in a protein. How to put the amino acids together to spell out a protein. It determines the spelling, basically, of that protein. What amino acids come next to each other in a protein. Right. Number 11. Oh, the first part of this, we're not going to cover. I'll have to look and see. I don't test you on this. Know how to use universal genetic code to translate messenger RNA to a protein? That's not difficult, but probably I'm going to skip that. But the next question, how many nucleotides in messenger RNA are required to determine one amino acid? So don't forget, how many amino acids are there? 20. There's 20. And you only got four nucleotides, so there's not a one-to-one. So you need more than one nucleotide to code for each of the 20 amino acids. So you need a sequence of three of them. It's called a triplet. And the triplet on the messenger RNA is what we call a codon. Okay, so how many nucleotides? You need three. So that universal genetic code is what we call a triplet code. And what the heck is a gene? I didn't tell you what a gene was, but it's pretty easy to see. Where do I have a nice picture? A gene is just a sequence or a set of nucleotides in DNA that has enough information to make a protein. I lost my slide. Yeah, it's just a sequence of nucleotides in DNA, which is sufficient to make a protein. So a gene is used to make a protein. Let me see if I can find this slide real quick. Yeah, I can't find it real quick. So I think I'll just leave it as that. At that, a gene is just a part of the DNA molecule that can make a protein. And a good place to start thinking about that is that there's a nice one-to-one correspondence between the number of genes in your body compared to the number of proteins that are in your body. So, for instance, if all the cells in your body can make 10 different kinds of proteins, how many different genes are in your chromosomes? There's only 10. Okay? But say you can make 100,000 different kinds of proteins. How many different genes do you need then? 100,000. Right? So each gene carries the information necessary to make one protein. And we're finding out now that a gene can actually make more than one kind of protein, but we'll have to take another class to see how that happens. So for this class, you can say for every protein, you need one gene to make that particular protein. What do we call that construct in our minds that contains all the genes in our body? What do we call that concept of all the genes that make up our body, that make up all the proteins in our body? What are the genes that make up all our body? What do we call that? You've probably heard of it. It's not in this book, I don't think. That's called the gene pool, or all the genes that all humans have, say in this room, that would be a gene pool. Okay, but all the genes in one person are what we call, you've heard of this term, the genome. Right, the genome is just a set of all genes in your body. Right, that was a real big project to find all the genes that make up a human. Did you ever hear the Human Genome Project? All right, so all the DNA was looked at to find out how many genes that made up a human body. Okay, that's not important for this class, but probably some of you have heard of the genome. That's just all the genes that make up a human body. All right, so look over those questions. And if something doesn't make sense by Thursday, then you got to ask me, and certainly ask me before the next test when it comes up. Okay, so probably the hardest thing in this chapter to see is respiration, aerobic versus anaerobic respiration, but I think if you break it down the way we looked at it in class, it's not too bad. Right, in terms of where it takes place and what kinds of molecules it produces. All right, let's start the next chapter, which is tissues. All right, so I think we're already familiar with what a tissue is because we're using that structural hierarchy of organization in the body. What's the smallest piece of information that we looked at that makes the body, the smallest building block of the body? An atom. Yeah, an atom. And if we put atoms together, we get a molecule. And if we put a bunch of molecules together, we get even something smaller. Yeah, you could say macromolecule. If we take macromolecules, put them together, we get a organelle. We put a bunch of organelles together, we get a cell. Okay, we get a cell. And if we put a bunch of cells together, what do we get? That we get as tissue right here. So that's what a tissue is. It's a group of cells with a similar structure, but not only that, all those cells are behaving pretty much the same way. They have the same function. And even the material that's between the cells is going to be similar. And what do we call all that junk between the cells? That's the extracellular material. Extracellular means outside the cell. What do we call all the material inside the cell? In this nomenclature, it would be what? Intracellular. Right? For sure it's cytoplasm, but it is also intracellular material. Oh, thank you. I have lots of handouts, and I'd be happy to share them. Look, here's that transparency I was looking for. Oh, well. I don't need all these handouts. So take one, pass them back. Extras, you can just leave in the back of the room and I'll get them after class. Okay, so starting, I've got handouts up to the next test, but after the next test, then you'll have to find your way to Blackboard and download the class notes from Blackboard. Okay, unless you let me know. Now, you got to Blackboard because that's where I put your grades. Did you find your grades on Blackboard? And if not, before you leave today, let's log on, make sure you know how to log on to Blackboard or Thursday or sometime to do that. Okay. Yeah, so keep passing them around. All right, so a tissue is what? A group of cells, similar structure and function, so similar anatomy and physiology. And also the material that's outside the cells is similar too. And histology. Oh, here's another ology. What's anatomy? Structure. Anatomy is study of structure. What about physiology? Study of function. What's the study of chemicals? Chemistry. What else did we have to know? Well, that's it so far. All right, and then the study of tissues is what we call histology. Oh, we did study another one that I didn't mention. It's the study of how cells function. That's called cytology, the shape of cells and how the internal workings of cells. That's cytology. But when they all come together in a tissue, that's what we call histology. So that's a little bit more complicated than cytology. All right, so histology is real important because we should know how cells are organized together to perform certain kinds of functions and how different tissues come together to form organs, because we can't understand an organ system, which is what we're going to get to real soon, unless we know something about tissues. So tissue is a basic building block for organs. And that's a building block for organ system. And what's the organ system a building block of? That's a building block of you, right? The whole organism. So we have to know something about tissues. And as a matter of fact, most disease processes are most evident and easiest to understand at the tissue level. So tissues are real important. The nice thing about studying histology is that it's not really all that complicated. There are only four kinds of tissues that make up your whole body, and that's handy. There's an epithelium, that's one kind of tissue. There's connective tissue. The third one is muscle, and muscle probably is what you're most familiar with. What is muscle specialized to do? Movement. What it's specialized to do is to contract, to shorten, and when it shortens, it moves stuff around inside your body. Right, and then nervous tissue. Maybe you've hit your elbow and felt some electricity or pain in your elbow when you hit your funny bone. Right, so nerves transmit electrical information in your body very, very quickly. And then there's a fourth kind that sort of doesn't fit in. It's a combination of an epithelium and a connective tissue. We call that a membrane. But it has a lot of attributes of an epithelium. All right, so let's look in some detail. What the heck do these four different kinds of tissues? And you know what? It'd be really good for you to become familiar with these tissues, because you'll rely on your understanding of tissues in all of your studies. No matter where you guys go from here, you'll always be thinking in terms of different tissues. All right, so the first kind of tissue is which one? Epithelium. Let me put this slide back where it belongs so I know where it is. Okay. Epithelium. Epithelium covers something, covers surfaces of the body, or maybe lines the cavity. So an epithelium covers a surface, so coverage is the important concept for epithelium, or lines a cavity. So your skin is doing what? It is covering your body, and that outer layer of your skin is really epithelium. But the lining of your gastrointestinal tract, that's an epithelium that lines the tube, your gastrointestinal tract, and even blood vessels in your body have a lining on the inside. That's an epithelium as well. Okay. Epithelium also forms glands. So can anybody name a gland for me? Sebaceous gland. Yeah, that's made out of epithelium. Sebaceous gland is in your skin. It secretes an oil, helps lubricate your skin, helps you from drying out. Salivary gland, tear glands. All these glands are made out of epithelium, so that's an adaptation of epithelium to secrete a product. Epithelium has very little extracellular material. What's the extracellular space? That is the space inside the cell or outside the cell? Outside the cell. That's right. So there's very little space outside the cell. So that means that the cells are really close together. They're touching each other. There's very little space between them. So that means it's what? Made mostly of cells. It has a free surface. I'll have to show you what that means. But on your skin, the free surface is what? Just the outside world. Right? The free surface is just the surface of your skin. It has a basement membrane. So again, your skin, if you were to dig down into your skin, you would find a basement membrane at the bottom of your skin as opposed to the free surface. And an epithelium never contains blood vessels. This is kind of strange, because we just said that ATP is so important to keep cells alive, and ATP is made, a lot of it, in the presence of oxygen and mitochondria, right? But an epithelium is so thin that it's never really far away from a blood vessel, but nonetheless, they don't go into the epithelium. And you might be kind of aware of that already. You've maybe cut the epithelium, which we call epidermis, on your skin, maybe with a little paper cut. Did you ever get a paper cut and you go, oh, that hurt really bad, and you look and you see a little tiny cut right there, but it's not bleeding. And the reason why is because an epithelium never has blood vessels, but it does have nerves. You probably cut a nerve, but never didn't go deep enough to cut a blood vessel. So that's good to remember. So how do we classify an epithelium? One of two different ways. We can classify an epithelium by the shape of the cell or by the number of layers that make up that particular tissue. So let's start with shape. The different shapes are, they can be flat. And a flat cell, what do we call a flat cell? That's the first one right there. Squamous. Do I have it? Oh, we don't have an illustration in your book. Okay, well, I'll make an illustration. Okay, a flat cell is going to kind of look like, right, like that. That's a flat cell. Oops, let me put this in here, like that. So that's a flat cell, kind of looks like a pancake. So that's what we call a squamous cell. Or they could be cuboidal in nature. What does a cuboidal cell look like? Like a cube. All right, so here's a cube. It can be cuboidal in nature, like that. Or they could be columnar. What does that look like? So like a column, right? So here is a columnar cell. So these are the three basic shapes, flat, cuboidal, and columnar. And we'll develop an eye to see these things. The second way that we classify epithelium is by the number of layers. If it is just one layer, we call that a simple epithelium. So for instance, if this right here is the basement membrane, which I'll just abbreviate basement membrane, and this right here is the, what did I call it right here, the free surface. So if you go from the basement membrane to the free surface, I only see one cell right there. So that would be a simple epithelium. But if it's stratified, what do we have? So if here is the basement membrane, and here's the free surface, and let's make them all kind of flat. Here's a flat cell, here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. I see four flat cells as you go from the basement membrane to the free surface. This is what we would call stratified epithelium. So when we use these terms of classification to describe an epithelium, we got to use both the shape and the layers to completely describe what we see. So how would you describe this epithelium right here? It is stratified and it is also squamous. So this is a stratified squamous epithelium. But if the epithelium just looked like this, for instance, what would you call that? So here is the basement membrane right here. Here's the free edge or the free surface. As you go from the basement membrane to the free surface, how many cells do you see? One. So what is it? That's a simple epithelium, and the shape of these cells are cuboidal. So that would be a simple cuboidal epithelium. So that's how we would use the terminology to describe that epithelium right there. All right, so let's look at some microscope slides that you have in your book. Okay, so what do we got right here? Well, what you should always start to look for on when you're looking at an epithelium is find the free surface or the free edge. That means that there's not going to be any material out here. That's just going to be open, either to the outside world or maybe a tube that's inside your body. And the basement membrane. So here is a basement membrane. I'm almost covering up, but can you kind of see a line going right through there? All right, so now when you go from basement membrane to the free edge, how many cell layers thick is that?
One.
That's one. I see a nice nucleus there, and the cells are real flat, So this would be what? A simple squamous epithelium. And I hope that says that right there. Okay. Let's look at another one. Let's look at this one right here. Oh, well, that's, I thought I was picking up a different one. But let's take a look at this. I don't see the basement membrane. We're looking down on top of a cell. And these are just all like pancake-shaped cells. So I can't really tell you for sure that this is stratified or simple. I just know that it's a simple epithelium and that the shape of these cells are squamous. So I'm going to put this one aside. Okay, because I'm asking you to look from the basement membrane to the free surface. All right, what about this one that's upside down and backwards? Doesn't matter. All right, so here is the micrograph. Do you see a nice smooth structure right here, that circle? What's that smooth circle? That's the basement membrane. And what am I pointing to right here? That's the free surface. And so going from the basement membrane to the free surface, how many cells do you see?
One.
Just one. And what is the shape? What's the shape of those cells? That is a cube-like cell. So this is just a simple cuboidal epithelium. All right, simple cuboidal epithelium. Here's an illustration, but this picture is so clear, you probably don't need an illustration to see that, right? It's a simple cuboidal epithelium. Oh, no, I want to put this over here, because we'll have fun with these in just a second. Okay, here is another kind of epithelium, because here is a space that's inside your body. All right, so this is the free edge right here. And right here is the basement membrane. And right here is a cell. So what's the shape of that cell right there? That's columnar. And how many do you see going from the basement membrane to the apical surface right there?
One.
Just one. So it's a simple epithelium. It's a simple what? Columnar epithelium. And it just so happens that this epithelium has some little structures over here. These are probably cilia or microvilli. That's so it looks like it has a little fancy border right there. All right, these cells that have this little pocket right here makes it kind of look like a little wine glass or something, or a fancy water glass. That's called a goblet cell, right? Because you call those glasses goblets. And the job of a goblet cell is to secrete mucus onto the free surface. And mucus will protect this epithelium. All right, I'll mention that a little bit later. So the job of a goblet cell is to secrete mucus. Oh, it says right there. All right, so simple columnar epithelium. What's another good one? All right, here's one that's maybe a little bit more complicated. But what are the things that you're going to look for first? Basement membrane, the free surface, which is right here. Here is that free area, maybe the outside of your body or the lining of a tube. And of course, I can see this guy right here. That's a goblet cell secreting mucus. These are cilia that are beating. This would be a good example of an epithelium that lines our airway, our trachea, for instance. And what about these cells that we see right here? It looks like I see one here, but then I see a nice big tall one here, maybe a nice big tall one here, short one with a tall one on top of it. All right, and here's one that's kind of squished like that. So depending on where you look, sometimes it looks like one cell all the way from the basement membrane to the free surface. Sometimes it kind of looks like two. So we have a hard time making up our mind if it is simple or stratified. So this particular one we call pseudostratified. Pseudostratified, because you can't tell. But it's easy because pseudostratified columnar, so this is pseudostratified columnar, always have these cilia on them. All right, so pseudostratified columnar epithelium. And that's the kind of epithelium that lines our trachea and bronchi. And so these cilia are beating all the time. Guess which way they're beating? They're sweeping. Up or down?
Up.
Okay. Because your lungs are a dead-end sac, And this mucus traps dust particles, the mucus from the goblet cells. And so when we inhale dust, it gets trapped in the mucus, and the cilia sweep the mucus, either two choices, down into our lungs. That would do what? That would fill our lungs up with dust and mucus, or they're sweeping up all the time, which are clearing those dust particles out of our body. So indeed, they are sweeping up mucus and dust that we inhale all the time into our mouths. And then when we get it up into our oral cavity, what do?
Swallow it.
Yeah, just swallow it down, right? Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out, right? Okay. So that helps protect your lungs from getting filled up with dust particles. Okay, pseudostratified, ciliated, columnar epithelium. All right, let's look at another kind of epithelium right here. Here is the nice basement membrane. I don't know why I drew on it like that. Okay, I can tell you in a second. All right, so here is a nice basement membrane. Do you see a nice line right there? Here is the free surface way up over here. Now, is this a simple or stratified? Easy to see, right? That's a stratified epithelium. And when you have a stratified epithelium, you characterize the shape by the shape of the cells up here by the free surface, not down over here by the basement membrane. So what do these look like up on the top? Squamous. So this would be a really good example of a stratified squamous epithelium. And this is the kind that we have in our mouth, for instance, and on our skin. And this kind of epithelium is designed to be on parts of your body that are experiencing abrasion or rubbing all the time. Like your skin is being rubbed all the time. And so these cells up over here just get rubbed off, but that's not such a big deal because the cells underneath it do what? They come to the surface and replace those that are lost all the time. So right on the surface of your skin, those pretty much are all dead cells right there. And if you just gently scratch your skin like that, I probably picked up a couple million cells underneath my fingernail, and now I just kind of licked them all in the room. But that's okay because your skin is made to do that, right? So these are the living cells here. These are the dead cells. So they move up to the surface. All right, so always find this basement membrane. That's real important because you can tell some disease processes. You always look for a nice continuous straight line. But if for whatever reason you see a nice jagged line like that, that's a sign of trouble. Maybe a cancer or something that's not obeying the normal rules for growth. And those cancer cells are doing what? They're breaking out from the epithelium and going to other places of the body. We call that metastasis. And of course, that's very dangerous and deadly when that happens. And that's easy to identify if you're trained to see what? Nice, smooth basement membranes everywhere. It usually sticks out very easily. So always look for the basement membrane. All right. This right here. Here's the free surface. Where's that basement membrane at? Right through here. So how many cells do we see? Just one? You know what? I see two right over here, and they kind of look cuboidal to me. So for instance, right here's one, right here's one. I see two cuboidal cells in that area right there. So this would be an example of a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Stratified cuboidal. This one is hard to see. Basement membrane, free surface. I see one columnar cell there. I see another columnar cell there. So this is what? Simple or stratified? Stratified columnar epithelium. All right, so I think you're getting the hang of how to name these things. And then we have a real strange one. Okay, and I think you even have a question in your student study guide on this particular epithelium. We can see the basement membrane right here. But now look at these cells. Do they look cuboidal? Do they look columnar? No. Kinda, but no. Do they look squamous? Do they look flat? No, not really. So here's one that doesn't really fit into any of these neat categories. It for sure is what? Stratified. Okay, and this is what we call a transitional epithelium. And a transitional epithelium lines only a couple places in your body, and that is the urinary bladder and the ureters, which is a tube that you use to void the bladder. And what can you tell me about the bladder, the shape of the bladder? It changes. It's not like the shape of your heart. Your heart beats a little bit, changes shape, but not very much. But what happens to your bladder? It expands when it's filled up with urine, and then when you void, it shrinks back down. So it's got to stretch and contract, stretch and contract. And so this epithelium has to do what? It's got to stretch and contract all the time. So this example right here is when the bladder is empty and the wall of the urinary bladder is contracted. And when it's filled, these cells change their shape. Guess what they look like when the bladder's full? They get stretched out. They look very squamous. All right? So this kind of epithelium can change shape from being thick and not very long to being very thin and very long. And so these cells have to change shape. They can go from something that kind of looks like a bunch of pillows layered on top of each other to being very squamous. So they can transition from one form to another depending on the state of the bladder. All right, so I think we're going to stop there next time, and we're in pretty good shape for the quiz. Oh, here's an example right here, when the bladder's full, as compared to when the bladder's empty. All right, so it makes a transition. Here's when the bladder's empty, here's when the bladder's full. Let's log into the computer. So people interested to see how to log into Blackboard, stick around.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay, I'll double check.